from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Next up on Forum this morning, author and former New York Times food columnist Mark Bittman believes you don't have to be afraid of baking. His new book, How to Bake Everything, breaks down seemingly complicated recipes for everything from New Orleans beignets to Afghan snowshoe naan, making them accessible for even novice bakers. Bittman also adapts traditional recipes for the vegan diet, and he'll join us this hour to talk all things baking after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program, second hour. Mark Bittman, former New York Times columnist and author best known for his How to Cook Everything series, joins us this hour in studio to talk about his newest book, which is called How to Bake Everything. We're going to talk about other things as well. Maybe everything is a good word to use. Here it applies to, well, all kinds of desserts, knishes, calzones, bialys, you name it, breadsticks, how to bake all those things. And welcome back to the Forum program, Mark Bittman.
Great to be here. My annual visit, I guess.
Yeah. Well, it's great to have you. And we're going to talk about lots of things this hour. But first, let's talk about baking because you got a whole book on it and you seem to enjoy it and really almost promoting it. People need to learn about baking bread particularly because, as I learned from a video I saw of yours, even a six-year-old could maybe make better bread than the bakeries are doing.
Well, I've met some young kids who are doing some amazing things these days. It's insane. This kid came up to me the other night and said, and he couldn't have been more than eight, and said, I made tart tatin last night. It's like, God, that's really like, I know adults who have problems with that. Anyway, baking to me is an important subset of cooking, and the idea here was to say just that, that this false distinction between baking and cooking, to say baking is science and cooking is art, is false, really. That baking is part of cooking. If you can cook, you can bake, and vice versa. And I wanted to try to do for baking what I think I've done for general cooking, which is to just say, here, this is this really accessible chunk of cooking that you can do, and that's rewarding and fun and important and so on.
Well, there are also challenges in baking. You know, I mean, say you go to Thanksgiving dinner and somebody says, he or she baked all the pies, and that gets, you know, plaudits. It gets, in fact, a sense of admiration because maybe people don't bake as much as they used to, or baking pies was more of another generation.
Well, you know, if we go back 50 or 100 years, it was important to get calories. I mean, it was a goal to get calories. Now we don't really have to have that goal. In fact, for many of us, the goal is to eat fewer calories. So an easy way to get calories is to take flour and fat and combine them into a crust and throw something in the crust and then put something else on top. That's a pie. That's a lot of calories that, you know, are not bringing you a ton of nutrients. So now I think we're a little more careful about making things like pies. We recognize that they're occasional foods, meaning both you have them occasionally and you have them on occasions. I think that's the right approach to desserts, is that they're celebratory, they're often communal, they can be gifts and so on, but they're not something you want all the time.
Since we're talking about, for example, baking bread, do you have a position on gluten?
Yeah, I wish it would go away. My position on gluten is that if you're celiac and it's a problem, that's a problem. If you're not, my guess is you won't be thinking about it 5 years from now. When people come up to me and tell me that their knees hurt and they stopped eating gluten and their knees stopped hurting, fine, but there's no science backing that up, let's just say.
Speaking about science backing up, you have a bete noire out here fellow named Henry Miller. I guess Job had his boils and you have Henry Miller. And he has written about, let me give you a sense of some specifics about what he brings up with you. He's at the Hoover Institution and a former FDA drug regulator.
And a former taker of money from the tobacco companies who then went on to say that smoking wasn't harmful. So let's put him in the proper context.
Well, he puts you in this context. I just wanted for the get your response to it. Bidman's columns gave voice to the food movement's various rants about the American food system, often pointing the finger at the evil U.S. food companies who somehow managed to feed 310 million Americans each day, plus a few hundred million more around the world.
Wrong.
Cheaply, reliably, and safely. Bidman is the kind of, let me just read the rest of this and get your response, pretentious food snob who says unserious things in a serious way, hoping to lend his idea some intellectual heft, ideas like converting suburban lawns into vegetable gardens and mandating that vending machines sell fresh fruit instead of Cheetos. Response.
Well, let's take one of those things at a time, can we? Let's go. Read me the first sentence.
Bidman's columns gave voice to the food movement's various rants about the American food system, often pointing the finger at the evil U.S. food companies who somehow managed to feed 310 million Americans each day, plus a few hundred million more around the world cheaply, reliably, and safely.
Okay.
That's
one sentence. We are a net importer of food, so the American food system does not, in fact, feed everybody in the United States and feeds, again, net-wise, fewer people than China and India around the world. So we don't export. We don't export more food than we import, and we don't feed more people than we feed here. So that's wrong. Next.
Bidman is a kind of pretentious food.
Yeah, well,
stuff.
That, of course, I am. So,
who says unserious things in a serious way?
Well, actually, I say serious things in an unserious way.
Hoping to lend his idea some intellectual heft, ideas like converting suburban lawns into vegetable gardens and mandating that vending machines sell fresh fruit instead of Cheetos.
Well, what the hell is wrong with that? What's wrong with converting lawns into vegetable gardens? And what's wrong with selling fruit instead of Cheetos?
Well, it reminds me of something else. I want to bring up Henry Miller. I also want to bring up Dean Ornish. You have been a strong supporter of his, and you have identified him as being a leader, really, as he is, in terms of health and eating healthy and so forth. What do you say to people who say, that's just too difficult a diet. It's too ascetic. It's almost lying on nails or something along those lines.
Well, I Dean's most extreme diet is for people who've had heart disease. So, yes, it's too ascetic for most of us. But if you've had a heart attack, you want to eat in a way that's going to make you healthier, his ways have been demonstrated to work. So I think he's a pioneer. I don't think he's right about everything. I don't think any of us is right about everything. But he's a pioneer. He's done great, great work. And that doesn't mean that everybody needs to reduce their fat intake to below 10%.
You know, I was also just in getting ready for doing an hour with you this morning, looking at some of your columns in the Times and reading some of the stuff that is now, of course, part of Immortality, I guess. Like I like to think of our forum archives. And there were some fascinating things in there. Just like, for example, Malcolm Gladwell asking a question, why is there only one type of ketchup and so many mustards?
I'm sure Malcolm Gladwell answered that question.
He did answer the question, but it's just one of those questions out of the blue. Or you were writing about the fact that, getting back to food supply, most of the United States could supply 80 to 100% of their population with food grown or raised within 50 miles.
Well, you know, the sad truth is that the near majority of what's grown in the United States today does not go to feed people. It goes to make ethanol or to feed animals. And a lot of that which goes to feed people goes in the form of junk food, because soy and corn are the primary ingredients in junk food in the form of sugars and flours and oils. I don't know about within 50 miles. I think that's an exaggeration, but I think that most people in this country could eat regionally if we organize things differently. That's obviously not going to happen tomorrow. That's not an easy fix. But having millions and tens of millions of acres devoted to what amounts to biofuels and junk food is probably not the way to have a healthy population.
You still doing the part-time vegan thing?
Vegan until six, yes.
Vegan until six, yeah. That was one of the last books you did, I know. And what happened with the Purple Carrot? Can you break that down for us?
For those who don't know,
it's a startup.
I joined the meal kit startup, a vegan meal kit startup, a year and a half ago and left about a year ago. It was a 6 month. And let's say that it didn't live up to my hopes and dreams, and that was probably as much a factor of what my hopes and my inflated hopes and dreams as it was a disappointment on the part of the company. But, you know, I learned a lot. I had a lot of fun, but things were not going where I needed them to go for my own fulfillment. So company's doing well. I still have a small stake in it. And, we'll see what happens with meal kits in general.
Again, come back to Henry Miller here. He criticized you for not wanting all that nutritional information on those purple carrot menus.
Well, we were sending people vegetables. I don't know how much nutritional information you need about vegetables, but I'm happy to debate Henry Miller anytime. I don't think you want to be his proxy.
Well, I want to have the two of you in the studio. I would love to do that one day and give it a shot. We actually have an outstanding promise of a couple of big debates that I thought would be really delicious. Can I use that word? and somehow never came off. But we can work on that. Let's talk about meal services in general, though. I mean, your thoughts, reflections on that?
Well, you know, my goal at Purple Carrot, or my primary goals, were to try to send really, really great ingredients to people, but also to make sure that we were making progress on reducing packaging, because that's to some extent what horrifies many people about meal kits, and that we were treating our workers right. And we made some progress on the last of those things, but the packaging thing, we didn't, and I don't see that anyone really has. And the sourcing, you know, I know that Blue Apron, which is the biggest meal kit company in the country, is having trouble finding the kinds of ingredients that they'd like to ship. So this is a very, very young business model. It remains to be seen what'll happen. Michael, I haven't paid that much attention to it since I left, so I don't know whether the segment is growing or shrinking even.
You missed that? You missed a column? I mean, you're living on a farm now, aren't you?
I am living on a farm. I miss the platform, but I don't miss the deadlines. I'm looking for what my best platforms will be. I'm not going to go back to being a weekly columnist. And I actually, you know, would like to continue writing about both cooking and what I think about food, and I will.
And I know you miss being in the East Bay and living here in the Bay Area.
I do miss Berkeley, yes.
Why is this may seem like an off-the-wall question, but it always interests me when people have passions like you do about wanting, well, your fellow citizens to be healthier and to, you know, be aware of the dangers and perils of food and just to eat in ways that will make them healthier. You know, I've pretty much explored this with people like Michael Pollan. In other words, what's driving you here, you know?
What's driving me?
I mean, wanting, for example, better compensation for laborers, tracing the food back to where it comes from, all of those sense of what we put on the table and the importance of and significance we give to it in terms of our own lives.
I would like to see, it's maybe naive, but I would like to see the world become a better place. I think the way that we do that involves food and many other things. I don't think we can, in isolation, fix the food system. It's much more complicated than it seems at first, and it's much more interrelated with many other parts of the economy. So I think it's fair to say that if I have a goal or I have a philosophy, it is that I would like to see the well-being of the general population increased and the misery level of the general population decreased. That's pretty simple.
Is that altruism to you?
I don't know if it's altruism. I mean, if I felt like I made a dent in that, I'd feel really good. So there's ego involved also. But it's something I've thought my whole life, and I, I don't see that we're making progress. And, I don't know whether you want to go here or not, but if we don't take climate change seriously, a lot of this is out the window. So, I'll just say, when you have a presidential candidate who doesn't even believe in climate change as if it were, some kind of fairy that you could believe in or not.
A fable from the Chinese was his original statement.
Yeah.
That's where he said it came from.
Yeah.
The Chinese
did it to wreck our economy.
Yeah. Well, so when you preach, you're kind of a preacher in some ways. I mean, when you're talking about climate. No, seriously.
Right.
But, for example, you feel sometimes you're preaching just to the choir?
Well, there's always a few outliers in any audience, and hopefully you change some minds now and then. But if I am preaching to the choir, then I can say to the choir, let's all work as hard as we can to convince people who are not in the choir that what we're saying is we want to move the world in the right direction. Let's see what we can do about that.
I said preacher, but maybe teacher too. I mean, you want people to understand the dangers to the planet and to their own health. I mean, don't you? Isn't that what you're all about?
Yes. There was a Kurt Vonnegut book called Sirens of Titan, in which
I know it well.
So correct me if I'm wrong. He organizes an attack from that appears to be coming from Mars in order to unify the human race. This is what climate change is showing us, that we are one family, that humans can survive or not, and that, geologists have declared that we are now in the Anthropocene era, which means we are an era where humans are determining the future of life on this planet, not only for us, but for other species as well. We have the power to determine whether that future is a more or less happy one or a more or less catastrophic one. We can only do that by uniting. We can only do that by acting as if we're one family.
Well, of course, you mentioned Donald Trump. He's also said that he will tear up the agreement that was made in Paris if he becomes president of the United States. We're talking, by the way, if you just joined us, with Mark Bittman.
We're talking about baking.
Yeah. Well, no, we started off talking about baking, and we got a little half-baked here. But I want to do this. I want to invite listeners to join us in this conversation. And I should mention his new book is called How to Bake Everything. He's written more than a dozen books, including VB6, Eat Vegan Before 6 O'Clock, and How to Cook Everything. In fact, we discussed the Eat Vegan Before 6 O'Clock book with you. Let's just pause there for a moment. This is a moral question in terms of not eating animals as much as possible?
Well, there is a moral question about animals. And I think, it would be generous to say that 10% of the animals in this country were raised in humane conditions. So I think it's important for us to eat less meat. Having said that, I think there's a role for meat in both agriculture and in our diet. It's just we're not approaching things the right way now.
And I should mention that Mark Bittman will be appearing tonight at the Jewish Cultural Center of San Francisco at 7:15 with a 6:15 pre-event signing at Unchartered, the Berkeley Festival of Ideas, on Friday at 3:15 p.m. and on Sunday in Oakland at Market Hall Foods at 2 p.m. In the meantime, let's hear from you, our listeners. Questions, comments? We're talking about a whole range of things. We started off talking about baking. It'd be interesting to hear some of your baking experiences. I don't know if we got to get weighted down into gee, Mark, how do I bake pretzel sticks or something like that, or certain kinds of desserts, although there are a lot of recipes in this book, to be sure. But experiences of baking might be interesting for you to let us know in a nice, cogent way, and we do invite you to join us in the program with questions or comments. Obviously, talking is unavoidable with Mark Bittman about all kinds of related issues where food is concerned and where eating is concerned and staying healthy and so forth. You can join us now at 866-733-6786. That's the toll-free number for your calls, 866-733-6786. You can also, of course, email us, forum@kqed.org, or post questions or comments onto our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. And you can also, of course, tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. Any ways you can become part of this program. Here's Amy, who writes, I hated cooking because my mom was a restaurant critic and we had a very high standard in our house. But then a friend gave me your book, How to Cook Everything. It made cooking so much less intimidating. And your pie crust recipes have earned me much praise, even with my mom. I can't wait to purchase your new book. And P.S., I'm also using your books to teach my kids who both love to cook, thanks to you.
Well, what
always
can
nice
I say?
To hear, right?
I should leave. I don't know. Let's wrap it up here.
Anything else is anticlimactic.
Right.
But we'll get some callers on. Ron, hi.
Hi, this is good, great show. In my mind, I've been out here in San Francisco over 50 years working with global garden projects focusing on organic. And my question, and looking for someone with your authority, we have regulations, food regulations, that what is below the regulatory level, there are hazardous toxic substances within our food products. How do we change government to get food products to eliminate the hazardous substance that are existing within the regulated product?
Well, this, you know, of course you're right, and it is a problem, and the FDA has recently reviewed the generally recognized as safe regulations and decided that they're okay. We have a system by which industry is responsible for saying whether new additives are safe, and we that is FDA, relies on industry to do that testing. That's something that ought to change. And, you know, to back up a little bit, the first thing that needs to change is that candidates for office, regardless of their affiliation, need to pay attention to food issues because they're important to all of us, obviously. And I think our job is to make candidates, not just presidential candidates, because most of us don't have access to them, but candidates for Congress and local office as well, to say, what are you doing about, for example, the FDA regulations? What are you doing about antibiotics and the food supply? What are you doing about industrial production of animals? What are you doing about unregulated pesticides and so on? And I think we need to push candidates for office on all levels on food issues. And I think that's our first step.
Let me thank the caller, and we'll go to Maria Cause in just a moment. But one of the things I'm interested in hearing about from you is when you talk about a healthier and a better world and everything, reducing misery. There are many people, very thoughtful people, scientists I'm thinking of, Robert Goldberg, UCLA, for example, who wrote the anti-labeling issue on the – happens to be an old friend of mine, who believes strongly that GMOs don't represent the threat that you and so many other people in the food movement.
Don't. Go ahead. But
well, no, I'm just bringing this up because you could feed a lot more people, is Goldberg's argument, if you just let you weren't so concerned about GMOs or trying to, in other words, label GMOs. You could, and they don't represent the risks, he would argue as well, that many believe they do.
Let's not lump everyone together on GMOs because my position is more nuanced than as you just expressed it.
Fair enough.
It's a technology. Is the technology working? Not really. That is to say, it hasn't increased yields and it hasn't reduced the GMOs that are being used, and FDA approves them all the time. The GMOs that are being used have not increased yields, have not reduced the use of pesticides and herbicides. When we see products that do those things, they'll be considered successful.
Well, you reminded me of some news yesterday. I'll come back and maybe talk about this a little bit. Just yesterday, journalists swarmed a Soma wine bar here in San Francisco to hear about plant-based Impossible Burger. You know about this?
I do.
By genetically modifying yeast to produce heme, an iron-containing molecule in red meat, the company's created a bloody burger that's pink when raw and turns brown when it's cooked and is bioengineered to mimic the taste, smell, mouthfeel of beef. We'll hear what Mark Bittman has to say when we return. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're spending this hour with Mark Bittman, food writer, author, and former New York Times columnist. His new book is called How to Bake Everything, and he'll be tonight at the Jewish Cultural Center in San Francisco at 7:15 with a 6:15 pre-event signing. And that's at Uncharted, the Berkeley Festival of Ideas. He'll be there on Friday at 3:15 and on Sunday in Oakland at Market Hall Foods at 2 p.m. We're going to go right to your calls and emails. A lot of you want to get in the air here and talk with Mark Bittman. But what about bioengineered plant meat coming to San Francisco and L.A. restaurants? How does that make you respond?
Well, I was completely skeptical of that product, Impossible Foods. But I went down to Redwood City to try it, and it's pretty impressive, and I also believe that they are they're monitoring the resources that it takes. Because that would be my first question: is, you know, okay, you can make a plant-based burger that tastes like meat, but can you do it? Can you minimize or can you lessen the amount of resources that it takes to make this fake meat versus real meat. And there's some questions to be answered about it, but I think it's a real stride.
On the whole,
sort of an awesome product.
I
mean,
agree with you.
Taste-wise, it's fantastic. So.
And what about there was an item I came across, again, in this kind of Harper's Index sort of thing with a lot of the stuff that you used to include in some of your columns about Whole Foods overcharging by overstating weight, I mean, on prepackaged foods?
That was last year.
Is that still a problem for them, do you think?
I don't think it was a problem at all. I think it was I don't want to be in the position of defending Whole Foods, but I do think that was a bit of a tempest in a teapot.
Here's Helen, who says, I agree on trying to give people more food awareness. I went through a number of stages at the California Culinary Academy, Le Cordon Bleu, and was appalled by the food served, frozen preformed hamburger patties, buns, etc., she says, et al., from Costco at fancy yacht club restaurants. It turned me off. I don't cook professionally, and I don't eat out if I can avoid it. And now we go to some questions. Clarice writes, we're about to buy a new stove after years of pretty poor version. And the mid-range stoves, any features you think are more important than others?
Well, that's, you know, very dear to my heart because me too. And there are some super high-end stuff. There is some super high-end stuff out there right now, I think, with a lot of unnecessary bells and whistles. I'll say a couple things. One is that induction burners finally work. So that's worth considering, although they're still a little temperamental. And the other is when I look at stoves now, I want to make sure that at least one and preferably two burners has very, very high heat, over 15,000, preferably over 20,000 BTUs, and that at least one burner can do a real simmer, very, very low heat, I guess under 5,000 BTUs. So other than that, it's, you know, about having grates that are stable and a stove that's easy to clean and so on. It hasn't changed all that much.
And we go to your calls, and let's bring Claire on. Claire, you're on.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Mark, I wanted to let you know that I really appreciate your work and the evolutionary nature of your work. And I have a fresh baby food company I've been running here in San Francisco for about 5 years. And use the How to Cook Everything Vegetarian as inspiration for some of the purees that I sell. And I teach baby food classes to moms and mothers groups and always bring that book, not necessarily as I'm not necessarily advocating being a vegetarian so much as I'm using it as a really great tool to give to moms that aren't necessarily huge cooks in their home, but give them simple ways to make really great food for their babies. And that book has been like my Bible.
Well, thank you for that.
And figured that might be a use of one of your cookbooks that you weren't aware of. So we use it for baby food inspiration.
Appreciate that.
Yeah.
That's great.
Thanks for the call, Clara. Good to hear from you. Again, we're talking to Mark Bittman about his, about a lot of things, about food mainly, of course, naturally. As I think I said earlier, his new book, How to Bake Everything, breaks down some pretty complicated recipes for everything from New Orleans beignets to African snowshoe naan, makes them accessible for even maybe a novice baker, and also adapts traditional recipes for the vegan diet. You may want to join us with questions or comments. Our toll-free number again is 866-733-6786, or email us forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum. Let me go to the website here. Monica writes, I had a surplus of fresh herbs and nuts, so I made three pestos, basil pine nut, tarragon cashew, parsley pecan. Any ideas on how to use them?
I'd be really curious about this tarragon one because tarragon is so, so strong, and usually I use it, but unlike the other two herbs you're talking about, I use tarragon by the pinch, so even fresh tarragon, just a sprig or two. So I'd be curious how that turns out. I mean, I love those kinds of pastes on...
Yeah, I said African snowshoe naan. I meant Afghan snowshoe. Thank you, Irene.
There you go. You could use those pastes on Afghan snowshoe naan, but also on any white fish, grilled meat, incorporate into salad dressings. I mean, those herb pastes are so useful to have around. Let's blend into soups. I mean, almost anything.
Here's Bill who writes, I gave up on baking bread using a bread machine because I couldn't produce a loaf with a texture lighter than a brick. Is it, in fact, possible to bake a decent loaf of bread in a bread machine?
I'm not sure what a bread machine does for you other than allow you to take the thought out of baking. It doesn't save time and it doesn't save much work. You know, the most popular recipe I've ever been a part of is called No Need Bread. That is a recipe that...
You say that's life-changing to you?
It was life-changing for many people. Not so much for me because I baked bread before, but my bread is better than it used to be. And that's it's a technique where you let the dough sit for long enough so that gluten develops without kneading, and then you bake it in a covered pot, which mimics a steam oven that professionals use. And the bread is awesome. And if you made one of those, especially if you started with 100% white flour, you made one of those without messing around, just a white flour bread, I think you'd be stunned, really stunned. And no bread machine can touch what that's like.
Well, I saw that video with that fellow you were working with.
Jim Leahy.
Jim Leahy, yeah. Just water, flour, knead, and salt, and no tricks. And you've got bread that looks yellow inside and really is very rich.
10 years old, that video. It's probably been seen 5 million times.
Let's go to more of your calls, and let's bring Barbara on. Barbara, you're on. Morning.
Oh, hi. Thank you so much. Mark, I'm a longtime bread baker. And the no-knead bread recipe was a revelation for me. But I also found in the Laurel's Kitchen Bread Book, they talk about kneading 100% whole wheat bread with no added flour in the kneading process. It's super messy and kind of annoying, but it really works. And it makes great, because it gets all up on your wrist, you know, and it itches and stuff. But it makes this great bread that's beautiful when you slice it. It's like you can see this gray gluten and the little flecks of bran, and then it keeps forever because, I guess, of the gluten. Why does bread with high gluten like that keep better?
Well,
and why does that kneading work? Would love to hear your opinion.
I have a bread like that I call travel bread, but all whole grain flour keeps very, very well. All whole grain bread keeps well. I'll have to look at that kneading process again. That's an old recipe. Laurel's Kitchen is from the 70s, I think, if not the 80s. But I'd have to have a look at that. But yeah, sounds fun.
We, by the way, have posted a couple of recipes from your book on our website, kqed.org/forum. You might want to talk about it. I think we put flourless chocolate cookies and olive oil cake.
Well, those are two of my favorites. The chocolate cookies are almond and egg white and cocoa powder, basically. And they are glossy in appearance, almost black, meringue-like on the outside that is a little bit crisp and soft on the inside. They are amazing. That's my favorite recipe in the book, and that's why we gave it to you. Olive oil cake is really an interesting thing because, people have baked with olive oil in Europe forever, and we don't really do much of that, but that cake is delicious. And people who've had almond cake or orange cake in a Spanish style have had cakes like that. I think I really like it. I think it's worth a shot.
And there's a listener named Judy who wants to know your thoughts on the new baguette vending machine. Have you tried it?
I have not. It's new. I have not heard of the new baguette vending machine. Oh. I think we should have vending machines that contain Cheetos only, actually. But where is the baguette vending machine?
I don't know. The question comes from Judy. If you can let us
Judy,
know where
write
the
us
baguette,
back.
We're curious about where that machine is. Another comment from, a listener asks a question. He said, I'd love to hear Mark Bittman's opinion on corporate lobbying and its influence in current policies. Anything we can do as citizens?
I'll go back to what I said before, which is we need to make our feelings known to candidates the way lobbyists make their feelings known to office holders and candidates. There's an interesting website that I'm working on called Plate of the Union. It's kind of a cute name.
Clever.
POTU is the hashtag, and it's a campaign by Union of Concerned Scientists. I'm doing some work with that organization. And the goal basically is to say to candidates, food matters. And I think we need to make our voices heard in that regard on a whole variety of issues. Whatever issue people think is important, the way that this country works is that our voices have to outweigh lobbyists' money.
It's sometimes almost like banging your head against the wall, isn't it?
Well, at our age, we only have a few more years left of it anyway, so it's not that painful. I mean, but what else are you going to do? If you're not hopeful, then you might as well give up.
Have you given us your two best favorite recipes? You want to add one or two?
Well, the no-knead bread would be my third. Those are the three first recipes I would try from this book. No-knead bread, olive oil cake, and those cookies are, like, astonishing. So great.
You know, I once asked Jacques Pepin, I'm going to ask you the same question, the joy of, call it the joy of baking, the joy of cooking, whatever, and I said, you know, sometimes you put so much work into a full-course dinner, for example, and a lot of this baking involves a good deal of work, too, and toil, labor. What's the reward for you when people eat it all, especially if you're not eating it? And his response to me hit his head, and he said, the memory.
Well, that's interesting. I feel differently.
It's like Proust, I guess.
You know. I don't feel that way. I feel like when I add water to that basic flour mixture of the no-knead bread and stir that together and the smell of the flour and yeast arises, I really love that. When I put garlic in a pan of olive oil and that sizzle happens and sits there bubbling away, and I just love that experience. I love the process of cooking, and I know that Jacques, Jacques is capable of many more things than I am. He's a great chef. I've never been anything like a great chef, but I know that Jacques on a daily basis cooks very simply and loves doing that. I think that's the joy right there, is just preparing things from real ingredients that don't take a lot of time or effort, and turn, it's magic. It's really magic. And baking no more nor less than other cooking. And then, of course, the fact that you're nourishing other people, especially when they're your children or your loved ones, but when they're your friends or even strangers, it's just an awesome feeling.
Listener writes, I just heard the topics announced for the third presidential debate. The country will have four major debates with not one climate change question. And I would love Americans to understand how our food supply contributes to the warming. This seems like a major abrogation by the media and debate committee. Your thoughts?
Yeah. Well, this is a major abrogation by politics in general. And, Hillary Clinton, to her credit, has at least mentioned climate change. And I doubt that she'd dismember the Paris Accords, but the Paris Accords have to be more than a piece of paper. And if you look at the Paris Accords and you look at the latest numbers on climate change, we can actually not allow any more oil or gas exploration, and we can barely take out of the ground the oil and gas that's already in motion to be exploited, extracted. So we need a national policy to be working on renewables right now. That is also an employment, a job-creating machine. Bill McKibben has likened climate change to World War III. It's not far off. We need to prioritize this in a big way.
We haven't done enough with renewables, though. I mean, there's been a lot of going back. Now Al Gore's out there campaigning for Secretary Clinton, and I'm just reminded about all of that kind of pie in the sky about all the renewables that would make for many more jobs. I mean, there's been some of that, admittedly, but, you know, there's been some real failures, too.
The failures are in the fact that the world, at the current rate of extraction of fossil fuels, the world is doomed. I don't know what could be a bigger failure than that.
So should we go more nuclear, do you think? We were talking a little bit about this off-air.
I think you're talking about, it takes a long time to build a nuclear power plant.
That's true.
I'm less anti-nuclear than I was 20 years ago. I think many of us are. But the technology is there for solar and wind and for electric cars. I think that's where the future is, and I think that's where our money should be going.
Question from a listener named Hillary. She wants to know, what do you do with the sourdough monster in your kitchen? I am a little bit neurotic about throwing food away, especially when it's expensive. King Arthur organic flour. I use my sourdough mostly for English muffins and pancakes. Do you have other healthy ideas for using extra sourdough? Pretzels, maybe?
Well, you can use it in place of yeast whenever you want to, but true confessions number one is that I got rid of my sourdough starter. I felt like it was running my life, and I didn't like that feeling. It's just the obligation is it's just overwhelming. So I'm back to yeast. I like yeast. I like the taste of yeast, and I like the convenience.
And we'll bring another caller on with Mark Bittman. Roger joins us next. Roger, welcome.
Oh, thank you. Mark, I wanted to ask you about the book How Not to Die by Michael Greger. Since reading it, I saw your book in Costco, How to Cook Everything Vegetarian, and I bought it. It's fantastic. And I find that I'm now practically all vegetarian, more because of what I've learned in the book, How Not to Die. And your book is so easy to follow.
Well, thank you. You know, I'm not as familiar with – I have looked at How Not to Die. I haven't read How Not to Die. But I will say that I think the rules about food are pretty straightforward. And one is to make sure that the food that you eat is actually food, because some very high percentage, 40, 50% of the stuff that's out there does not meet the dictionary definition of food. You know, Michael Pollan would call it edible food-like substances. You could also call it unidentifiable food-like objects, but whatever. And then the second rule is to eat more plants than you did last week, and then eat more plants than you did last month, and eat more plants than you did last year. And that's not becoming a vegetarian or a vegan. That's becoming someone who shifts his or her diet into what amounts to a sane direction.
Let me thank the caller. You know, I came across in your book, this is kind of amazing to me. I'm not sure why it's amazing to me. There are 10 varieties of fritters, and there are 18 types of flour. I mean, you get into the real sort of extraordinary nuances of types and varieties and all this kind of stuff.
I think the lesson, and I've been doing this, you know, this is actually my 20th book, and most of them are cookbooks. And my first was published in 94. I started working on it in 1990. It was called Fish. And I look at what I've done, and the pattern is very similar. You can synthesize much of this information. And the things that those 21, whatever the number was, flowers have in common are much greater than the things that set them apart.
But they make a difference in taste, don't they?
Yeah. But I'm saying in cooking, the patterns of making a fritter, a pancake, a cake, and so on are common. So you learn patterns, you learn templates, and you're able to do things in a much easier way. When you approach a cookie recipe, you say, oh yeah, I've done this before. There's just a few swaps here.
Thank one of our listeners, Tiff, who has solved this great mystery. She tweets, or he tweets, Tiff, I guess, maybe.
The baguette machine?
Baguette vending machine is at the Myriad Market in the Castro.
Well, and what happens? We need a video.
It's half-baked bread, I guess. And then you order it, it bakes.
Well, whoopee-doo.
Let me get another caller on here. Dilip, you're on. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you very much. I'm an Indian person of descent, and I see in a lot of Indian grocery stores there's a lot of whole grain flour that they have started carrying these days. I just wanted to know if I can replace all-purpose flour with whole grain flour for different recipes like pizza or bread or things like that?
The answer is yes. I would recommend that you start by replacing 25% of white flour with whole grain flour and see how things go, and then move to 30, 35% and see how things go again. If you're like most people, that's going to be enough, because when you hit 50%, things start to break down in terms of, I wouldn't say quality, but in terms of some of the features that we want out of bread start to disappear when you start replacing more than half of white flour with whole grain. I'm not saying it can't be done, and we were talking about 100% whole grain bread before, but the characteristics really do change.
And we thank you for the call. You were talking before about both an agreement on this, Jacques Pepin as being one of the great chefs, and I noticed you got a plug on the back of your book from another great chef, Mario Batali. Are there great bakers?
You know, just to say, Jacques introduced me to many of the old great French men chefs back in the 80s. I was lucky enough to meet him when I was 35 and he was 50, and now I'm 66 and I guess that makes him 81.
He had a big 80th birthday celebration.
Yeah,
we talked about it on the air.
He's one of the great, not only food personalities, but people I've known in my life. There are great bakers. I mean, you have Chad Robertson here and many, many others. I think we are seeing a resurgence in baking. We're seeing a resurgence in growing great grains. You know, Bob Klein from Oliveto is doing fabulous things with wheat here in California, where people in the Northeast starting to grow beautiful varieties of wheat and other grains. And we are seeing every town you go to above a certain size at this point has a legitimate good bakery at, you know, these days.
Laurie writes, what about the bee crisis?
The what crisis? The bee crisis. Oh, well, the bee crisis, I think in part it's mowing down milkweed. In part, it's using neonicotinoids as pesticides. In part, I think there's some other stuff going on that we're not quite sure about. I would regulate neonicotinoids, and I think that monoculture is an enemy of biodiversity, and we need some kind of legislation that says a certain amount of every sizable farm has to be set aside for biodiversity. And, you know, at sustainable farms like Full Belly up in Cape Hay Valley and a couple places in Iowa, they've demonstrated that if you take 5 or 10% of your farmland and set it aside for biodiversity, your yield actually goes up, doesn't go down. So this is not costing anybody anything. But the fact that our fields are so, you know, the Heartland's fields are so big, and the machinery is so big and so complicated, so sophisticated, that it is difficult to break fields up at this point. But that's what's going to have to happen.
What are you farming? What are you doing up there?
I'm not farming.
You're on a farm?
I didn't say I was farming. I said I was living on a farm.
Are you raising your own stuff? I mean, raising animals,
for example?
No,
I have a garden, and I've had a garden whenever I've lived not in the city. I actually had two gardens this year. But we make jokes about farming, but I'm not farming.
Let me bring another caller on here, and this is Raul. Good morning.
Hey, good morning. I always love your program.
Thank you.
Great to have you guys. The question is, if we want to grow something in our front yard or backyard, even with a smaller plot, like, you know, 5x5 or 10x10, how we can do that, where we can get help on that, is something we want to grow organic, and how we can spread that out for so many people, so, you know, it'll be healthy.
Well, you know, you get your soil tested. Your Cooperative Extension Service can do that for you. No doubt you need to add nutrients, which, if you want to be organic, is likely to be in the form of composted manure or plain compost. And most towns now let you go to their dump, or what do we call them now, transfer station, recycling center, and get compost for free. And, you know, here in the Bay Area, you can be planting stuff now and you can be eating greens all winter. So there's tons of information about gardening online. And what I would say is you have to, Henry Miller notwithstanding, you have to make sure that your town's regulations do not forbid you from turning your front yard into a garden, because that does happen in some towns. But backyard is always safe.
Again, we're talking to Mark Bittman, a food writer, author, and former New York Times columnist. New book is called How to Bake Everything. Did you finish this book and feel maybe there were some things that you should have included, might have included, and didn't include, especially with the everything in the title?
Well, you know, the everything is a bit, it's not tongue-in-cheek, but it is a marketing strategy. It's not everything. It's a lot of stuff, though. I think that this is my fifth How to Cook Everything book, fifth in the series, and it's a management challenge, because, you know, I can show you a list of 10,000 baking recipes, and obviously I have to make decisions about what stays in and what goes out. I like this selection. My most embarrassing moment was the original How to Cook Everything did not have a recipe for chicken pot pie, and I felt that was a terrible omission. But so undoubtedly there's some bete noir like that in here, but I haven't found it yet.
Well, I want to remind listeners that two of Mark's favorite recipes are at our website, kqed.org/forum, from the How to Bake Everything book. And the recipes are for flourless chocolate almond cookies and olive oil cake. He was almost drooling in just describing his delight with those. Actually, speaking about almost drooling, this is not customary for people like us to be accused of being mean. But here's Kate, who writes, it's mean to put on a baking show from 10 to 11 a.m. when everyone is craving something from the pastry case.
Well, we didn't mean to be torturing you, Kate. Sorry.
Do you have favorite pastries?
Well, I'll tell you another thing in this book that I really like, and you can see that I tend towards savory, but my favorite project is making croissants, which takes, you know, up to 48 hours.
It's a long time.
Not a lot of work, just a fair amount of attention and alertness, because you have to come back to the dough every now and then. But the finishing steps, which you can do on a Sunday, ideally a Sunday morning with people you really care about assembled, the finishing steps of turning this dough into little triangles, rolling the little triangles up, shaping them into half moons and baking them, it's miraculous. And there is nothing better than homemade croissants. Nothing. It's insane how great they are.
Were you part of that fervid desire for those croissants that were, what do they call them, cronuts? Or they were hybrids of croissant and donut?
No.
There were long, long lines in New York City.
Well, you know, those people have to put sugar in everything. That's not how I am.
Yeah, well, it was a silly question to ask. You're with the Bob Lustig School, right?
Not quite, but yeah. Closer to that than the Cronut School, for sure.
Again, congratulations on your new book. Thank you for joining us. Mark Bittman, author of How to Bake Everything. He'll be at the Jewish Cultural Center in San Francisco tonight at 7 p.m. and at Uncharted, the Berkeley Festival Ideas, Friday at 3:15, and Sunday in the Oakland Market Hall Foods at 2 p.m. And we're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11. Appreciate your listenership. You can always let us know what you think about what you hear on Forum by emailing us, forum@kqed.org, or suggest topics. For all of us at KQED, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.